Welcome to Enlightenment of Change with Connie Whitman of Whitman & Associates. Here's Connie.
Hi, I'm Connie Whitman, your host, and you're listening to Enlightenment of Change on webtalkradio.net. As always, you know I am pleased that you are joining us this week. So my motivational quote today is actually by one of my favorite people in the whole world, and it's Stephen Covey. And he says, it's a long quote, but it's very impactful for our topic today. So Stephen says, where we stand depends on where we sit. Each of us tends to think we see things as they are, that we are objective. But this is not the case. We see the world not as it is, but as we are, or as we are conditioned to see it. When we open our mouths to describe what we see, we in effect describe ourselves, our perceptions, and our own paradigms. When other people disagree with us, we immediately think something's wrong with them. So now, do you think that your way of living is the correct way? Do you judge those that maybe don't live their life exactly the way you do? Yes, you do. So come on, admit it. We judge people every day. And we all do it, and we think we're right. So who is living the right way, or who's to say who's living the right way? And are you, am I, our friends and family, are we living correctly? So these are some really, really, I think, pretty deep questions. The reality is we all have different filters based on several layers of human experience. So is your perspective the correct one? In the next half hour, I'm really excited to have my guest today. We're going to boil down this huge topic and share some ideas and concepts that are going to actually help you live a fuller life as soon as today, right after the show. So my guest today is Dr. Frank Pasciuti. Frank is a licensed clinical psychologist and certified hypnotherapist in private practice. He lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. He is the founder and president of Associated Clinicians, I hope I said that right, of Virginia, which provides psychotherapy and organizational development services to individuals and businesses. Now, Frank is chairman of the Institutional Review Board at the Monroe Institute in Faber, Virginia, and he collaborates on research related to NDEs, psychic phenomena, and the survival of consciousness at the Division of Perceptual Studies. Oh my God, his credentials are so extensive. He's also the author of the book we're going to discuss today called Chrysalis Crisis: How Life's Ordeals Can Lead to Personal and Spiritual Transformation. And I'm so excited, Frank, to have you on the show and to discuss this life-changing book. So thank you for taking the time to be on.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate being here. I look forward to dialoguing with you about it.
Yeah, and you know, I was trying to shorten your credentials so that it's not this very long introduction, but I was like, I can't cut that. I can't cut that. So your credentials are extensive, and the book is fascinating, and I'm so excited to share that with my listeners today. So my first question, Frank, is what is the Chrysalis Crisis, and why did you choose to give this that particular title to your book?
Well, a straight definition would be a chrysalis crisis occurs when an individual is confronted with a life ordeal and initially unable to fully heal or integrate the experience. But in the effort to do that, they usually, the struggle to do that usually requires them to develop a number of key areas that we're all like learning to develop and master. And so, in the process of working through the crisis, they develop areas of that may have required, you know, sort of some growth, and it can lead to transformation. So while we might not say, geez, bring me more crises in life, oftentimes you may look back and say, I had that crisis, it was really powerful, and yet as a result of that, the work I did afterwards really led me to grow a lot. And so when I find that with working with people in therapy, like for instance, a number of different people may come in with the same kind of crisis, going through a divorce, death of a loved one, but yet their ability to get through that, or after they get over the initial impact, there's usually a pivoting point where you might say, okay, so what is there that needs to be learned here that will help you continue to grow through this and put it behind you? Somebody may have, they're less able to get in touch with feelings. Maybe they need to do some grieving, but they're not comfortable with sadness or anger or fear. They may have ways of thinking about the experience, which makes it difficult on them. They may need to change their thinking and lean towards more cognitive kind of interventions. They may have some ways in which they have been isolated socially. They may need to come out of themselves more to make more connections with others. So there's about 10 key areas that I have seen over 45 years of doing therapy that seem to be more prominent. It's very broad, the scope of these, because it's like physicality to, you know, anything from, you know, social development to learning how to be more intimate and open. But these are all the different areas. So to answer your question more specifically, when I was reading once, I remember reading this story, which is kind of I write about in the preface of the book, where this little girl goes into her backyard and she sees this caterpillar and she sees it starting to, you know, develop a cocoon. It goes into the cocoon and she excitedly bides her time and keeps coming and looking to see what happens next. And then she sees one day the butterfly trying to break out of the cocoon, but she's noticing it's flapping its wings and it can't get free. And so she kind of felt like, oh, I got to help this butterfly. You know, it looks like it's trying to get out of there. And of course, touches the wings and it falls to the ground. And she's devastated. And she goes inside and talks to her mom. And her mom says, you know, sweetheart, that butterfly needed that struggle because not only did it help it finish the process of its transformation and probably put it in a language a child could understand, but the struggle to do that also strengthens its wings for flight. So it's a twofold thing. So I thought, wow, what a wonderful metaphor for the struggle we undergo getting through various crises, where the struggle itself develops areas of us that we then use for the rest of our flight through life. So, you know,
it's beautiful. It's just so beautiful because we think that tragedy or something difficult that's put in our path is a burden, right? Or we look at it like, woe's me, instead of looking at it, what's the blessing behind or what's the lesson behind? And it's just very interesting. As you were speaking, my husband's dad passed at right after Thanksgiving last year. And so he happened to be in the room, thank God, when my father-in-law took his last breath. But my younger son was with him. So my younger son, after the fact, he said to me, he was, you know, distraught. Now, you have to remember, my kids are 20 and 23 at this time, and they had four grandparents. So this was the first big loss that they've ever experienced. And the long and short of the story is, so my son didn't know what to do because he's never been in this situation. So he just put his hands on my husband's back, which was really so cute. So afterwards, he's sharing the story with me, crying, you know, did I do the right thing? I didn't know what to do. And I said, that was a pivotal moment in your life. And I said, it's so funny. We think we have to have the right words and we have to say the right thing. That simple touch was all you need. And so I tried to explain to him and my other son that life, this is life. Death is part of life, right? Unfortunately, it's the crappy part. But you'll have this pivotal moment that you and your father have this connection now that can never be broken. It's very deep. And then my husband and I were talking about events in our life, like you're describing, that were truly, truly hard. But what was that pivotal moment and what did we learn from it? And it's exactly what you're saying. And I hope my listeners are saying, oh, this tragedy occurred, but this is what happened as the repercussion from that. And this is a beautiful thing. And that the chrysalis, the story of the butterfly, how profound and how beautiful and how simple. And everybody listening, I'm sure we all learned that in like probably third grade, what a chrysalis is right in the cocoon. So just thank you for that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful metaphor. It's been around for a long time.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, I'd like to note that the Greeks once used the same word for butterflies they did for soul. And, you know, you go back, and especially I know you have a background similar. You had some Catholic influence in your early years, where St. Teresa and John of the Cross talked about the transformation that we go through as the similar to the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. So it's a lovely, beautiful metaphor, and, you know, and then it, you know, and similarly in the Chinese culture where they talk about crisis as opportunity. So as a therapist, you have to finesse it a little bit, because if you jump too soon into somebody coming in, if they're grieving, if they're really still maybe undergoing this process of being traumatized, you know, you really want to meet them where they're at and try to help them ground and get centered again. But there's always a point where, you know, you can look back and you maybe pivot a little bit and say, well, geez, it really, there seems to be some things that you're learning out of this. Like your son, learning empathy, a real experience with your husband where he there was no words needing to be said, but it was a beautiful thing. Yeah. And he was challenged by the moment and made a connection with his dad that'll probably last like a lifetime.
Yeah, and empathy, right? That's the lesson learned for a young person. We have to be empathetic. And you don't always know what to do, but whatever you do, it's better than doing nothing, right? So that's how we learn and we grow. Now, you mentioned the key areas of human growth in a couple of minutes ago can that require development. Can you give us what they are and maybe some examples so that people could help us narrow into what the, you know, the content of the book?
Well, you know, they're very broad, everything from just, and each area challenges all of us. And just because I can identify, and believe me when I tell you, I'm just as much out there trying to develop certain areas more than others. We have each one, they're kind of interdependent in their own way. But I break those 10 key areas into three different categories. One I'll call foundational. And if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy, Nita has a little bit of that, which is like physicality and everything about our physical world, mastering our, you know, as much as we can, mastering taking care of our bodies, mastering finances, food and shelter, the very basics, sexuality is all in there. The next one would be intellectual development, and that would be learning, developing curiosity, but learning about everything, about all the keys or about whatever you need to learn in life that helps you continue to develop. The next area would be emotional development. And like we have an intellectual IQ, we have an emotional IQ. And like your son just took a step in that empathy department, that's the sensitivity to reach out, but also being able to both register, identify, and express feelings appropriately. Some people, you know, were raised in certain ways, like as a child, maybe growing up in the inner city back in the 50s, you know, might have been like, you're not supposed to cry, or girls aren't supposed to get angry, or whatever. So culturally, sometimes you have a conditioned way of being told certain feelings are okay, or maybe they're exhibited inappropriately, but they do need to be experienced, and you can't think of feelings. So particularly in therapy sometimes, you know, I'll get people who are very intellectually inclined, well, they'll say, you know, they'll even say, I think I might be angry, and I'll say, well, are you feeling angry? Are you actually experiencing it viscerally? So there's physicality, intellectual development, emotional, social. There's another where you have a social IQ, where you learn how to engage with people, be astute to the subtle social things that go on, you know, being able to read a social situation. You don't have to be some sort of like social butterfly, but it might be just to be able to work in community with others and maybe benefit from a group, any kind of group, social group, family group. So there's a certain development there. And like, for example, I work, one of my examples in the book is a fellow who is very, very cerebral, very introverted, super high IQ, took care of himself physically. But when his wife died, he really wasn't able to tune into his own feelings or be able to reach out to his children as well. And he was very isolated because he was blessed with the ability to just go in his office and work on his projects. And when he came, after she died, he had to deal with things emotionally himself, had to nurture his children emotionally, and he had to come out socially more because he had to get out and start going to schools and talking with teachers, all the things his wife did. So for him, the growth in the aftermath of the loss of a significant other was emotional and social more. And then the last of the foundational areas that I call these five is moral development. And by that, it's more about being in a good place with feeling like you're doing the right things in life. And it's more about being at peace with yourself. And, you know, we all have our different codes. And, you know, and yet, if you're doing things on some level that you know is wrong, it's going to affect you in your conscience. And so you may have a crisis that comes about because even unwittingly, you might have done something that, you know, you created a crisis in your life. And you look at it and realize, wow, you know, I should have really like checked my moral compass before I did that or something. And then the next grouping I call more personal, because everybody can identify to those five and they're foundational. Everybody can also has access to the next three, which I call more personal, and they're identity growth, intimacy growth, and by that I mean the capacity to share openly with others, and existential growth. And the identity growth is like the who am I questions, and that changes throughout life. I'm a man, I'm an Italian man, I'm a New Jersey guy, whatever, all these different ways of identifying, but I'm also an American citizen, and I am a citizen of the world, and I even have capacities that maybe are spiritual. And so the identity expands, and it also adjusts the fellow who spoke a lot about that was Eric Erickson. He said, like, identities are like clothing. You know, sometimes you wear them for a while and they don't fit anymore, and you kind of outgrow them or you expand. The intimacy is interesting as a therapist, because sometimes people will have problems, they'll come in, but the whole idea of talking about such personal stuff is hard for them. So that in itself challenges them to learn to get comfortable being able to expose their thoughts and feelings, or really make a connection on a deep level. And people have varying degrees and capacities to do that. And then the third area in that section is what we call existential growth. And that might be finding meaning in life and purpose, answering the big questions. A lot of people don't think about death and dying unless somebody close to them dies. But, you know, at midlife, frequently people are coming in and saying, you know, I don't feel like my life has as much meaning or purpose, or aware of, like Carl Jung once said, a psychiatrist back in the days of Freud, you know, that when you are at midlife and you become aware that eventually you're going to die, those existential meanings, those existential areas start coming into play. Like, what is going to happen to me? What does happen after death?
Yeah.
And then I know I'm rolling on here, but the last two areas are what I call transpersonal. And these are interesting in that they, I identify those as intuitive growth and spiritual growth. And I use the category of intuitive growth to include experiences that some people don't believe are real, like psychic capacities. Like somebody, I have a subspecialty in my work where some people have what are called spiritual emergencies. They may have a dream about something that actually happens, and it would scare them. If they have no understanding about these psychic faculties, or they think it's a bunch of wishy-washy, woo-woo, you know, soft-headedness, and then they actually have like a near-death experience or something, and they are out of their body looking at themselves on an operating table, and they have, and so these are the intuitive and spiritual capacities. And I wanted to put them on that continuum because I believe all of these 10 areas are capacities of consciousness that we have access to within human form. Animals have some of those, you know, but we are a higher order, and not, you know, I'm saying just in terms of the range of capacities we have available to us, like self-awareness. And so any of these areas can be called into play, basically related to whatever crisis you're in. Somebody may come in and have, I have a number of people who may have had a near-death experience, and they've never really thought about life after death, or it scared them, or they wondered, how could I see what's going on, and I was clinically dead at the time. How do you explain that? So they're reaching for intellectual understanding. They may be needing to, like, ground themselves emotionally. They may be frightened by it. And other people will have, you know, a crisis where one of my clients back in the 70s, he had a previous near-death experience, and he suddenly started having precognitions, and he thought, he got frightened. He started having dreams of things, a couple of them, and they happened. And he thought, oh my God, am I causing this to happen? Am I the angel of death? Because he had a couple of visions of people, you know, and he was really stressed out, and he wasn't crazy. And the interesting thing is, you say, people off, the first question is, Doc, am I losing my mind? I'm having things happen to me. So it creates a crisis, but it's more like seeking understanding and learning to kind of get re-centered again emotionally. But all across the board, and the first two areas, the first area is more conventional kinds of problems people bring to therapy. The second can be more existential, more personal. And then the third area is more transpersonal. And, you know, I get fewer people on that end of the continuum than on the first end.
Which is funny because I think we're so much more aware now of that transformational piece, right? That evolution at the higher level of spirituality. I think we're so much more aware of that as humans than we were even a decade ago. So it's just funny that I'm sure you've seen an increase in clients or patients coming to you with those more, I'm going to use the word advanced. I don't know that that's the right word, but those more existential kind of issues. Now, as you were speaking through the 10 layers, and I that's why I didn't interrupt you, because I thought I wanted the listeners to hear the span of what those 10 components are, right, or categories are. And as you were going through, it was funny because I kept thinking, oh, that happened to me, or oh, someone that told me that. So as I hope my listeners were listening to that expansive explanation of the 10, that they could relate to each of the stages, because we really do go through, hopefully we go through all 10 of the stages. If you're not aware of something that Frank just shared, definitely read the book, but maybe you do have to do some reflection. Maybe you do have to look within and say, hey, wait, where am I? Because everything you just described should be, as humans, we should have the capacity to grow within or all 10 of those categories, correct?
I agree. And I kind of dedicate a chapter to each area and very much address it through examples and very layman-friendly terminology. I kept sitting, writing, and thinking, you know, this is not to be some heady, inaccessible book. I want to write, if somebody was in my office, how would I convey this to them? Matters not what level of education, what gender, it's more about, let me understand. Because people are bringing experiences in. And when they start with experience, like even on the other end, the transpersonal side there, where there are kind of rare, less frequent experiences, but when somebody has an experience, then they're looking for grounding and understanding. You know, some people pursue these areas totally intellectually, but you really bring it home when you have an experience. And you know, and the whole crisis gets your attention. Suffering gets your attention. It's unfortunate. You know, I open the book with the notion that all things change and there's always going to be some suffering in life. And nobody gets, not that we should be punished. I don't have a punitive belief that we should all come here to suffer. But I think when we are going through emotional pain or physical pain, it gets our attention. And so we're alert.
It's so interesting because I started the show this year. It'll be 7 years, and which I love doing. It just has helped me expand, excuse my abilities, you know, exponentially over that period of time. But the reason I'm telling you this is so when I started the show, I was really bad at it because I just didn't know what the heck I was doing. But in about a year, the owner of Web Talk said to me, "Okay, Con, you're only inviting Jersey people. It's like a Jersey show. You got to expand it." So, I'm a Jersey girl, right? So I'm like, okay. So I have to percolate on things, right? Think about it. So that night, I said to my husband, I had a meeting, you know, and I talked to her, and I have to, can't be a Jersey show. And he goes, "What are you going to do?" I go, "What do I know? I know people from New Jersey." So he said, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "You know what I know? I have no idea. So this is a blind spot for me. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm throwing my hands up. The universe will provide for me, and outlets are going to find me. I don't know what I'm doing." Within, I'm going to say, 2 weeks, I get an email from this publicist. Never heard of her. No one introduced us. And she says, "Hey, listen, I have an author from Hawaii." So I was like, "What?" So needless to say, built a relationship with her. Sarah, who's your publicist, she and I have become friends over the years. I don't know who introduced us through this, you know, network. She's introduced me to people in Spain. And so I guess about maybe 3 months later, I had people from all over the world on the show. It happened that quick. So my husband goes, "What, like, what did you do?" "Absolutely nothing." I said, "When I tell you, I had to surrender because I was getting upset. How am I going to do this? What am I going to do?" I started overthinking, and it started affecting me mentally. Like, I felt weak, and "You're not good at this. What are you thinking? Give up the show." We are, right, our negative record player. And when I surrendered, that's when everything started finding me. And we laugh to this day because it's 7 years, and people go, "How do you find guests?" I go, "I don't know. They find me." That's my standard answer. I make zero effort because the universe really does give me, apparently, I think that I'm doing something correct so that more and more folks are finding me and the show gets bigger and bigger, which is wonderful. True story, though, Frank. Sometimes you reach a point where you're like, "I have no idea." And then the answer comes to you. So it's just kind of cool, those synchronicities in life, right?
Yeah. Oh, I love them. I love them. Yeah. Definitely send, you know, you start. That's a fascination area for me, too. I spent a lot of time and with a colleague of mine looking at synchronicities and you know, how you kind of almost create a resonance. And if you're vigilant and all of a sudden it's almost like you start engaging in the world, things you gravitate towards, people, situations gravitate towards you. And you start realizing, wow, this is a real creative, we're all in this creative milieu. And, you know, the more you sort of, the more you stay resonant with certain kinds of thinking, you start bumping into people. And so it is a fascination. It's a beautiful thing.
It works. I think it was Wayne Dyer who said, if you change your thoughts, the world around you changes.
Yeah.
If you change, the world changes. It's just kind of cool. I have to ask, what contributed to you? Because you're fascinating, by the way, to speak to. Your demeanor is just amazing. All of your patients are so very lucky to have you. You just have a real nice, easy way about you to, I feel it's easy to speak with you. What made you decide to write a book?
Well, it's been kind of incubating for about 20 years, to be honest with you. I grew up in a family that was very interested in that third section. I mean, we were all just kind of like learning to get along with each other and dealing with all the very issues that come with the first and second section and those keys, first seven keys. But I had, I developed an early fascination. And I think part of it might have been also in combination with the Catholic upbringing. I was being exposed to all through kind of my schooling, by the way. We were interested, it was an organization called the Rosicrucians, which is a mystical non-sectarian organization that a couple of my uncles, my mom and a cousin, they were all kind of got connected to. And it was studying both mystical understandings, but also trying to put a handle on some of these exceptional experiences that you might call psychic experiences. And it wasn't, meant to be something like, hey, how wonderful we are because we're interested in all these areas, but more like addressing them as phenomena that are all part of the capacities of man. And at the same time, growing up in the Catholic Church, when these experiences would happen to Jesus or some of the saints, they were called miracles. And what was fascinating to me was that the early investigation of miracles gave rise to psychic phenomena investigations. And it was started with a pope. So that was intriguing to me. But you know what? That was like a little thing on the side, whereas I had gone to school and even majored in something else in both a master's and bachelor's program. But I always was interested in how do these exceptional experiences fit with normal psychological development. And that kind of geared me towards saying, okay, let me get in the field of psychology and see if I can make sense out of these. And so it's been a lifelong interest of mine to try to integrate an understanding that incorporates the whole spectrum. And back in my 40s, which I'll have to admit was a good 20, 25 years now, I went on my own little sort of like midlife campaign to try to find out as much truth as I could about all these different areas and spend some time with, past life therapists and shamans and breathwork people and,
fascinating
meditators and these different retreats. And started more actively on a regular basis meditating and doing yoga, which I had been doing since my college days, but really got serious about a daily practice. And I for me, it started then. I started saying, well, I want to keep working with this. And then I got more involved with this department at the University of Virginia, which actually researches reincarnation and mediumship and survival of consciousness and all that. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try to keep one foot in the camp of conventional psychology, but I also want to keep my mind open to what real research is going on in areas that a lot of people are quick to dismiss. And so the book is, in a sense, the culmination of that quest to try to put a handle on it all for me and then share it with whoever's interested. And then looking at it through the lens of crisis, because crisis just amplifies each area, right? So I can say, well, we can talk very intellectually about any of those key areas, but when you look at it or experience it through crisis, again, it really amplifies it and fleshes out some of the more inside learnings about each area. So getting the book written for me was a lifelong kind of quest. And maybe I suspect I'll write some more, but that was a long process because I had a friend who used to be an owner of Hampton Roads, who's in town here, and he shared something with me a couple of years ago. He said, read this copy, tell me what you think, because this is when the book was still about to be published. And he sent something to me, an email. He said, do you remember writing this to me like 16 years ago? I said, really? Wow. He said, don't you remember your early attempts to try to write about this? And I thought, wow, I have really learned a lot over the years because I can see how much I wasn't able to articulate that then, but I feel more clear about it now. So it's a long process for me. I never envisioned myself being an author or a writer. I always saw myself as mostly a clinician. But it's nice to get it out.
It's just so cool to hear that. I had recorded a show, I think, a week or two ago. It posted. And it was a woman who helps authors write. and like the statistics of another number of people who wish to write a book but never do, it's exponential. So even though there's so many new books coming out, more books maybe could be coming out if people had the confidence to do exactly what you did and write something that is had this deep passion within you that kind of needed to get out, really, is what I heard you say. But sometimes it takes such a long time to happen. We're almost out of time, but I'm curious about something. With your patients and with these 10 developmental areas, both on the personal and the transformational, emotional and transformational. Do you find that you need to be at a certain age to be able to go through each of those 10 transformations, or even someone who's truly young that's listening has the capacity and ability now to transform themselves? Did that just make sense? Is there an age?
Yeah, and I think some of life experiences, like for instance, the existential issues, may be more, to start asking about what happens after you die. But kids ask that at an early age. Sometimes, what is the meaning in life? Well, that might be pretty profound to be asking at 8 or 9 or 10. But maybe when you get to be, picking a major in college, you may start thinking about what would feel purposeful and meaningful. Learning how to be masterful of the physical dimension, which is learning how to take care of your body and exercising and eating right and managing money and living within your means and all the kinds of things we might say, those can be at any age, I think. And towards the other side of the continuum on the transpersonal, one of my colleagues and the person before him who was investigating, for instance, reincarnation, was children who remember incidences of what allegedly appear to be past lives. So that comes out. It's a age typically a lot younger, between 3 and 5. So some of these things present early. I know that I remember asking questions about death at about first grade because this little boy, and I share this story, who I went to walk to school with in Newark, there were 2 blocks, we'd meet up, and he died over a summer. And I wondered where he went. And I was in first grade. We did it, and we used to walk to school in kindergarten. And I remember asking my mom, what happened to Alfred? And then my grandfather died the next year. And I remember thinking, what does happen? I want to know. I was a student of at least, and that's not necessarily more precocious than the next kid, but what happens? What happened and where did they go? So these questions can come up, and all along the continuum to varying degrees. I have raised 3 children. They're all in their 30s now. I know that I wanted to try to help them label feelings, and I wanted to try to help them look at, developing some moral guidelines in life. And so they can be developed. But sometimes life events may bring some of them to the forefront at any age. So it's hard to say. Some of them that may lend themselves to, certain chronological periods in life. But I think a lot of them can be learned early. I would not underestimate, when you can start teaching kids to be aware of some of the. It's all about expanding awareness, right?
I agree. Yeah. So, well, and I don't know if you find this as well, but I'm finding more and more, because as I go to my corporate clients and I do the training for the sales, service, whatever it is, coaching skills, I have more young people, right? Because the millennials are coming through as the baby boomers are leaving and retiring. They're even a bigger population. So my classes are a lot of young, which I love. I mean, I revel in it because I love to hear or understand how they see things, to expand my perspective, as a late 50s woman. And I will tell you, more and more I am seeing that these young 20s and even early 30s, your kids' age and my kids' age, they are curious about the universe. They're reading more about synchronicities. They're asking more questions about, why do I think that way and the other person doesn't? So I find they're much more inquisitive than my peers. Definitely when I was in my 20s, I didn't think like that. But even my peers today, I feel this younger generation, they're so courageous and they're not afraid to address these really big questions. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know what? I'm reading a woman by the name of, what's her last name? Hubbard. Barbara Marks Hubbard. Mm-hmm. And she just passed away last spring, and I'll be brief here, but she talked about, she predicates some of her beliefs about creative evolution, conscious evolution, she calls it. She's kind of a futurist, and yet she was a profound woman who I'd recommend to your people, your listeners, look into her. She actually even got herself on the 1984 ticket for vice presidential candidate with Geraldine Ferraro. But she wasn't really meaning to be a politician as much as she's a writer and she's a teacher. But she talks about how we as humans are in this continual evolutionary cycle, and how information expedites it. So when you think about the millennial generation, they have so much information through right. the internet. I mean, that's like, think about the change after the Gutenberg press, right? All of a sudden people weren't, you know, I mean, there's these moments in history where suddenly access to information expedites growth. And I think you're right. And I love working with, by the way, the millennial generation.
Love
as
it.
A therapist. I mean, I have a paternal, not a take a paternal take with them, but as someone who could be their father's age, I enjoy mentoring and I enjoy helping them, and I do share with you. It's really very enjoyable to watch the curiosity and say, wow, they're not bound by some of the resistances or disbeliefs that we had in
100%.
Our generation. Because it, like they say, you don't change anybody's mind; people just die off. You know, the older generation.
It's true.
Well, they're less bound by it, so they're more open to these concepts.
It's true, but I never thought about that, Frank. It really is the information. Like, my kids will say something to me. We're having a conversation, and they'll share, you know, so-and-so said, or you know what book, and I look at them, how did you know that? Because I think to myself, you know, I didn't learn that till I was in my 40s. And they're like, I read it, I heard it on a podcast. Like, they look at me like I'm the idiot. Like, ma, it's out there. So it's really I'm fascinated because, you know, the generation gap, and for my listeners that are in their 50s and my listeners that are in their 20s and 30s, really be open to hear other people's perspective, because it's just fascinating to compare it to your own. And like I started with my introduction, is the way you're living the correct way? Like, really start to think about that, because we're all on this incredible, beautiful journey, and we all learn in different ways or see things in different ways because of our IQ, our EQ, all of the things we talked about right at the beginning. The book is just wonderful, Frank. Thank you so much. And you, again, I just have to compliment you. The way you articulate, these are big topics. These are heady topics that we're talking about. And I feel like you just brought it down to normal people's language so that everybody could understand. And I felt the book was written the same way. So thank you for that. And I do think it's a needed resource, because we're all seeking something. So read the book, because it perhaps can answer a lot of the questions or put you on the right track of what to read or what to look into. So thank you for that. I really do appreciate it, me as the reader, but also for my listeners as well. I love sharing people like you. There's so much value added in my perspective. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I appreciate your listeners giving me the time. And I also believe what they say, when the student is ready, the teacher arrives. But I think when we're ready for books or information, it comes to us, we find it, it falls off a bookshelf. If this book is timely for people, then great. I hope they can learn from it. That's the whole reason I wrote it. So
yeah, I love
thanks
it.
For having me.
Yeah, truly a pleasure. So guys, if you'd like to buy the book or you'd like more information about Frank, it's Frank say your name for me.
Pasciuti.
I'm like bleh this morning, right? FrankPasciuti.com. I'm going to spell it. So it's Frank, and then it's PASCIUTI.com. I promise, guys, I will post it on the Web Talk Radio Enlightenment of Change website, so that even if you're listening in the car, cool, you could go back and just tap into it, and I'll backlink it for you. So easy peasy to find. Frank, thank you again. Just such great content is I love providing good content and alternatives for people to learn and grow. So thank you so much for that. You guys, my partner and I are still offering our free communication style assessment on wisdomdecoded.com, my other business. And it really gives you some insight into how you're wired. And we speak to in the report you get about emotional quotient and your emotional intelligence and how that relates to how we're wired, because it could contribute to how you respond from an emotional perspective as well. Check it out, wisdomdecoded.com, free. You get a report, so it gives you a little bit of more insight about you as well. Thank you again, Frank. Thank you all for joining me again this week. And I hope you'll join me weekly as we question, build, and discuss discover, like we did today, that change is inevitable, right? Tragedy, like we talked about, is inevitable. Building blocks or stumbling blocks are put in front of us for a reason, and we can grow from it. And again, I hope my resource today, the book Frank wrote, but also Frank himself and the discussion we had, I hope it provides you as a resource of information for you to navigate whatever the change is that's going on in your life. And I hope you're realizing that change isn't a bad thing. It truly is, like the Chinese say, change comes that opportunity. So don't fear it, embrace it, and go for it. Thank you all for joining me. Thank you again, Frank, for being just such an amazing guest. You've all been listening to Enlightenment of Change with me, your host, Connie Whitman, on webtalkradio.net. I wish you all an inspired week. And please go buy the book. Check it out and see if maybe there's some enlightenment for you or a change opportunity that you didn't even know exists. Thanks, all. Thanks for tuning in.
You've been listening to Enlightenment of Change with Connie Whitman of Whitman & Associates. To learn more about Connie, visit her website, whitmanassoc.com. Thank you for tuning in. We're glad you were here.